Are there any questions on what we did last time? We're all good? So let me just remind you anyways that the main things we found last time was that a certain operator, namely the mass term of the scalar, received quantum corrections which were entirely sensitive to the highest energy physics that your theory has, right? Namely the quadratic divergence. And we also saw, towards the end, that this is the Lagrangian, I remind you, this is the Lagrangian that we have been talking about for quite a few lectures now. And we saw that, in fact, this Lagrangian is incomplete, and that several, well, mainly one more operator that we haven't written down will appear as a quantum corrections, right? The operators that has three scalars in it, right? And those two phenomena, one of them we emphasized a lot as the hierarchy problem, and the last one we emphasized a little less, but both of those problems are come under what's called technical naturalness, okay? And that's something that I just want to briefly mention to you. It's a definition due to Etouft. It's called technical naturalness. I don't know how to spell that. And what it says is that an operator, or rather the coefficient of an operator, right? So what when we talk about an operator, we talk about something like phi star phi, right? They each carry, it does a space-time field. This is the operator, right? Because it can create particles, it can destroy particles. And the coefficient of this operator in this case is the mass term, right? Here is another operator, y psi psi phi star, right? This is the operator, it creates fermions, destroys scalars. And the coefficient y is the strength of this operator. And the last one we saw yesterday was b phi, something like that, right? And again, this part is the operator, and the coefficient of it is the strength of this operator. And what technical naturalness says is that these coefficients can be small, or are technically naturally small, if in the absence of this operator, any one of them, the theory enjoys an enhanced symmetry. Okay, so what does that mean? So, if we look, for example, at the operator, if we again consider this theory, right, with the fermions, remember that we said that if the operator that gives you the mass term for the fermions, right, if this operator is zero, remember that one thing we have seen in the last few lectures, that if this operator is zero, then this theory has an enhanced symmetry, right? This theory has a symmetry under which the fermion rotates. Psi goes to e to the I theta psi. That's called the Weyl symmetry. Now, so technical naturalness says that it's technically natural for this coefficient m to be small compared to the cutoff, for example, if the theory really has this enhanced symmetry when I set it to zero. And this is precisely what happens in this case. When this operator goes to zero, when it's not present, the theory has an enhanced symmetry. Okay. On the other hand, in contrast to that, if I set this operator to zero, the operator that described the mass term for the scalars, then this theory doesn't have any additional symmetry. It doesn't really matter that I set this coefficient to zero. Even if I take this operator and I don't write it, the theory will not have any enhanced symmetry. There is no new transformation that you can do in the field that is suddenly a symmetry of the theory that wasn't there before. And this is the big difference between mass terms for fermions and mass terms for scalars. Mass terms for fermions, once you set them to zero, you're introducing a new symmetry into the problem, into the theory, namely this Weyl symmetry. Weyl symmetry. This is not true for scalars. If you set off the mass of the scalar to zero, it doesn't really matter. There is no new symmetry in the system. Yeah.
So, what is there a notion where two parameters, when we set them equal to each other, there's an enhancement?
Right. So that's what we'll do in a moment regarding supersymmetry. But let's just I want you to understand this business of technical naturalness, because it's much more general than just supersymmetry or what we'll discuss. But what happens if not only do I set, what if I set all the operators that have a scalar except for the kinetic term to zero? If I do that, then there is an enhanced symmetry. There is, if there is no operator that has the scalar in it, only the kinetic terms, then there is a symmetry under which the scalar goes to the scalar plus a constant. All right? So my theory will have only a kinetic term for the scalar, or any kind of derivative interactions of the scalar. I can write derivatives on the scalar, but I'm not allowed to write any kind of scalar itself, polynomials. This is known as a shift symmetry. And I mention it to you because I will mention something more general about this in a moment. But this is the only way we know how to protect scalars from receiving large quantum corrections. Okay, if the theory has something like that, where the scalar goes to itself plus some constant, then you are not allowed to write any mass term. Then mass terms will not be generated at loop level. Okay, and we'll see a concrete example. There are beautiful theories that indeed exhibit exactly this idea. All right, so this is the idea of technical naturalness due to Atuft. Now, the things that Tibra mentioned is that something we saw. We started seeing last lecture, and that is that if, in fact, the quartic lambda, let me see if I can bring this back. So one thing we saw last time is that if there is some relation between the Yokawa coupling and the quartic coupling, then the theory also has an enhanced symmetry. And that seems that's something that you will explore more in the problem set, where you'll show indeed that by setting, I think last time the relation I wrote y lambda equal to 2y, that was without putting the half in front. I think once you put the half in front, I believe the relation should just be y equal to lambda, but that's a detail. Yeah.
So technical naturalness is the idea then that coupling constants are naturally small if the absence of them is associated with a symmetry.
That's right.
But I'm wondering, does it also work in the other way? In both ways?
In the sense that if it's not true, then they'll have to be large?
Yeah.
So this is this issue of whether you allow yourself tuning or not. Because remember that what we call, for example, the mass term is really the bare mass term, the mass term at the highest energy scales, plus quantum corrections, right? So those quantum corrections are things like the loop corrections. In principle, you can always tune those things against each other and get a small number. There is no symmetry that forces those two things to cancel, but by hand you can do that. And in fact, this is what you do as an experimentalist sometimes when you turn a system into a phase transition. You tune the different corrections against each other. So there is no converse theorem. There's nothing that tells us that if it doesn't enjoy a symmetry, it necessarily has to be large. But that's our general expectations, because this is what you'll have to do. You'll have to tune two things against each other to get a small number back. So in general, if there is no enhanced symmetry, then you expect that thing to be large.
And so when we do it, why can we not tune it to be big when we do have the symmetry related? So you're arguing that we can.
Oh, no, you could. you could have it. You could just take the Burst thing to be very large. But the point is that just that you don't have to at that point, because all your quantum you see, the problem is what is the size of those quantum corrections? Okay, if you have a symmetry that protects. Okay, if you don't have a symmetry, then these quantum corrections will go like your cutoff square. Okay, so let me try to explain it this way, because that's an important point. If there is no symmetry that protects this operator, then your quantum corrections will go like your cutoff square. And then you have a large number, and you need to tune it against the large number to get small. If there is a symmetry that protects your operator, then this correction will only go like the mass itself, like m squared itself, or m naught, whatever. At this order, they're the same. And so at this point, you can make this one, you can choose this one to be small, you can choose this one to be small. Small plus small is still small. So the question is, how does this go? And the difference is that when you have a symmetry, this does not fill the cutoff. Well, there is always a sensitivity, there's always a log sensitivity, but that's weak. Okay? So what Tibor was referring to is that there are certain choices of the coupling. In fact, it's not just the coupling. You also have to choose the masses to be the same. But once you make those choices, there is an enhanced symmetry of the entire system, which is a very, very special type of symmetry. And that's known as supersymmetry. Okay? And so sometimes referred to as SUSY. And we'll mention we'll come back to the symmetry in a moment, but I want to first go back to something that is experimentally verified, namely the star model. But the reason why I mentioned the shift symmetry to you, and we won't have time to do it in this course, but that's another fascinating part of beyond the star model, and that is, so we have seen that supersymmetry is one way to get rid of this cutoff sensitivity. Right? We said that scalars generally have a cutoff sensitivity, and supersymmetry is a way to cancel this cutoff sensitivity and end up something that is only sensitive to the mass itself. But it's not the only way of doing that. The other way of doing it is indeed something like that, where your scalar actually has a shift symmetry under it. And this is precisely the reason why pions, for example, are light compared to protons and neutrons. They are roughly a factor of 10 lighter than protons and neutrons, and you should ask yourself, why is it? And the reason is because pions enjoy this sort of symmetry. Now, the symmetry is not exact. It is slightly broken, but it is broken very weakly, and so that they can be a little lighter than protons and neutrons. And theories that try to explain the lightness of the Higgs compared to the high energy cutoff based on this mechanism, roughly go under the name of Technicolor or composite Higgs. But in all those theories, the Higgs particle is something we call the Goldstone boson or a pseudo-Goldstone boson. Those sort of bosons, Goldstone bosons, are bosons which enjoy this sort of shift symmetry. Those are bosons which, if you write down what kind of theory describe them, those will be very interesting theories. So the kind of theories that describe Goldstone bosons, you have, of course, the kinetic term, right? Here is the kinetic term for a scalar. But now, because we have this symmetry, we are not allowed to write any polynomial. We're not allowed to write phi squared. We're not allowed to write phi to the fourth because we need to have the shift symmetry. The kind of terms we can write are things that have derivatives, like dime u phi to the fourth. We are allowed, it turns out that there is another term that looks like phi squared dime u phi squared. Okay? You might be a little confused why is this invariant, but there is a way to make those things invariant. But anyways, you need some derivatives to make this theory invariant. And those sort of theories are what's called chiral Lagrangians. Okay, those are theories that describe, for example, pions and other particles, also kaons. Yeah? That's right. So this term is a non-renormalizable term. There is actually a dimension. It should be some dimension to the fourth power here, and this is some dimension to the second power. So indeed, you have hit on a very important point, that this sort of theories, the very first interaction you can write down is already non-renormalizable, is already a relevant operator. But even though they are irrelevant, they are the only operators you have, so they are relevant in the sense that they are important for the physics. We didn't write any kind of operators like that for this theory because we had more important operators that will show up at low energies. But for these sort of theories where we talk about, for chiral Lagrangians, they start at non-renormalizable level. Now you might think, oh, this is crazy. What kind of theory is that? Oh, everything goes out of the door. But in fact, you know of another such theory. What kind of other such theory does that? That the first interaction you can write down is already non-renormalizable. So how many of you want to do quantum gravity or something? Okay, so any of you have looked at what general relativity does? General relativity, if you write it as a linearized theory, in fact has a kinetic term. And the only interaction that you can write down, the first interaction you can write down, is already non-renormalizable. General relativity does not have any renormalizable interaction. And this is precisely why it goes strong at high energies. And this is why it's so weak at low energies. This is why gravity is so weak, because the interactions are irrelevant at low energies. The self-interactions. Okay, so we won't have much to say about those theories, although they are beautiful theories. They enjoy many, many interesting properties. They describe the sector of gauge theories when they are broken. But unfortunately, we will not have that much time to cover them. But I do want to mention it to you because this sort of approach of thinking about the Higgs is a Goldstone boson. Higgs is a Goldstone boson, or what's called a pseudo-Goldstone boson, or a pseudo-Namu-Goldstone boson, is another viable way of trying to solve the hierarchy problem, and people have been working on it for a long time. As far as signatures at colliders and experiments are concerned, the differences are not as large as you might have expected. So we will cover in the next few lectures a few of the signatures you might expect from supersymmetry. The kind of signatures you see from here there are differences, they're not the same, but many of the things that you see in supersymmetry also have some analog in those other kind of theories like Technicolor or composite Higgs or little Higgs and all those things. Okay? But the basic mechanism is fairly different for how they want to stabilize the electro weak scale. All right, so I'm going to go back to the star model now, but are there any questions on anything here? Anything that you're still confused about, cutoff-wise, dim-reg-wise, symmetries? No? Okay. So let's go back to some things that you probably have seen, and that is so how many of you feel like, yeah? Go for it.
So you said something similar happens in GR, so does that mean then that GR has this shift symmetry?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, that's diffeomorphism when you linearize them. It's more complicated than just a single scalar, but it looks something like that. Yeah. I mean, in fact, if you talk about massive GR, massive spin two particles, those really do have a part of the field that looks like a scalar, and that scalar enjoys this sort of symmetry. And so, this business of chiral Lagrangians and scalar fields that enjoys those sort of symmetries is super, very, very important, but unfortunately we have limited time. But yeah, it's beautiful stuff. Okay, so how many of you feel like, you know, if someone wakes you up at 3 in the morning and asks you what is the star model, you will be up for the task? Okay, I won't raise my hand either because I don't like to be waken up at 3 in the morning. But I want to show you some very simple way to sort of remember the star model and what its content is. And here it is. Here is the way to do it. So here on the horizontal, can you all see it when I write things here? Is it visible? Yeah. So on the horizontal, I will write what are the gauge groups, what are the forces that appear in the star model. So the first one is described by U1y. Do you all know what I mean when I write U1y? So U1 represents the kind of symmetry group, the abelian rotations, right? And I have y represent hypercharge. I have SU2, and we usually put a subscript w to denote, to remind you that it's weak. The weak group, SU2 is the non-abelian special unitary transformations. And then there is SU3. And we usually put a little C here to remind you that this is the color group. Okay, that's what stands for color. So those are the different groups. And there is a kinetic term associated with this one. It looks something like -1/4 B mu nu. B mu nu. Can you all see this? Sort of, okay. So just the usual field strength squared. This one also has a field strength, W mu nu, W mu nu. And there is a trace over the SU2 indices. And this one is a -1/4 G mu nu, capital G mu nu. All right? So this is the gauge group. And on the vertical, I will put the matter group, or so the matter content. And we'll call it Q U D Li. So if you ever want to remember the Stammel matter content, just remember the short name Q D Li. All right? Now, what does Q stand for? Q is actually a two-component. It has an up and a down. And they are what's called left-handed particles. Have you seen this notation before? Okay. Now those ups and downs, those are the fermions, and they're exactly the type of fermions that we have seen here. Those are Weyl fermions, that there are two-component fermions. Okay? They don't have a mass term like this one. They don't have a Majorana mass term, but they are Weyl-like fermions in the sense that there are two components. Okay? And the left symbol is really mostly there to remind you that they are part of the Q, the two components. This is what we call the right-handed up. This is the right-handed down. This is again a two-component creature that is neutrino left and electron left, right? It's a vector. And this is what we call the right-handed neutrino. The right-handed electron. Okay? Now, there is one more complication that I'll mention in a moment. But then what we do with this table is that we just fill it up with the charge assignments. So the hypercharge assignments are pretty easy. The Q has a 6. The right-handed up has a 2/3. The right-handed down has a -1/3. The left-handed electron has a -1/2. And the right-handed one has a -1. Okay? The SU2 assignments are already pretty much given to you. The fact that this is a two vector tells you that this is this transforms like a 2 under SU2. This one is a singlet, so just transform like a 1. I'll put a dash just to remind you that it basically doesn't transform. It's not a charge. This one similarly does not transform. The left-handed guy is against a 2, and the right-handed guy does not transform. Now, this picture, if you show it to someone 50 years ago, or maybe almost probably already 60 years ago, they would be they would call you names, because they would never believe that our world in fact distinguishes between left particles and right particles. Right? No one believed 60 years ago or 70 years ago that our world fundamentally can tell between what's left-handed and what's right-handed. But these pictures that emerged over the last 60 years very, very clearly distinguishes between left and right. In fact, it's maximally so. Right? Left-handed particles feel entirely the SU2 weak. Right-handed particles do not feel it at all. Right? It could not be a more maximal violation of chirality. All right? So we have learned something over the last 70 years. The last thing is the color structure, and only quarks carry color, and they come as what's known as the fundamental representation, 3, and leptons do not transform. Okay, so again, dashes just means that it does not fill this group. It just commutes through this group. All right? So this is the content of the star model, almost. What am I missing? Huh? The Higgs boson, right? The one big thing that we have discovered, we've likely discovered in the past 2 years, is the Higgs boson. But even if we didn't know about the Higgs boson, there is something missing from this description. Two main things. First of all, that each one of those particles come up as 3 different generations, right? There is a up and a down, there is a charm and a strange, and there is a bottom, a top and a bottom, right? So there are in fact 3 different generations. Let me just write them here. So there is an up and a down, there is a charm and a strange, there is a top and a bottom. And similarly for the leptons, there is an electron and electron neutrino, there is the muon and a muon neutrino, and there is a tau and a tau neutrino, right? And so if ever someone comes to you and says to you, well, you know, nature is very simple. We should look for very simple theories. Occam's razor tells us that we should look for very simple theories. Nature is beautiful and simple. That does not look to me like a simple structure, right? Maybe in some very high energies it is simple, but this is just complete waste, right? We have 3 different generations for no obvious good reason, and they're just multiples of each other. So be a little wary about statements of simplicity, as they may be too simple. Okay. Now, of course, we don't want to complicate life more than needed, but we won't introduce more things than we actually need. But there is some level of complexity in this picture. Now, the last things that we didn't mention, except for the Higgs, is the fact that those particles actually carry masses, right? Those are not massless particles. Even the ups and downs, which are very light, carry some amount of mass. The electron, we know, carries some amount of mass. In fact, the size of atoms, right, the size atoms are, the size that we humans are eventually, has to do with the way the size of molecules and the size of larger structures, but ultimately it comes back to the size of atoms. What controls the size of atoms? What's the Bohr radius? Right, the Bohr radius has to do with the mass of the electron. In natural units, right, in natural units, the size of the atom is just 1 over alpha times me, where alpha is the e squared over 4 pi in natural units. So, in fact, life as we know it, like our size, is controlled by just the mass of the electron and the electromagnetic coupling. It has nothing to do with how heavy the nucleus is and how heavy the quarks are, or how heavy the muon is. Just has to do with how heavy the electron is, right? So definitely this generation controls many more parameters than the others, and particularly the electrons. All right. So, this current picture is a little bit strange because we said that those particles are vi-like fermions. And we cannot write a Majorana master because that will violate the charge assignment. And yet we need masses. We need something that gives masses to those particles. But if you look at this formalism as it is, there is no way in your Lagrangian to write mass terms for any one of those particles. So what gives? How do we give masses to those particles? And this is where the Higgs field comes in. There is one missing ingredient that once we write it, we can comply with all the symmetries of this theory and also induce masses to those particles. Okay, and that's a profound realization about this structure. But without the Higgs field, there is no way to give any one of those particles a mass and maintain the symmetries. Yeah?
So in low energy, can we not get masses from QCD?
Right, that's a good question. So that's a slightly more subtle issue, that indeed QCD itself breaks some of those symmetries. But let's leave that alone. I mean, even there, you need some sort of order parameter like the Higgs to do what we need. That's a great, wonderful point that unfortunately we won't have time to go into. But maybe we'll mention it. Okay, so what is that Higgs particle? The Higgs is basically like an electron. It carries the, so we, I'll denote it by H, and it carries the quantum numbers of a left-handed electron. So it's a 2 and a minus half under electroweak, so we'll just usually denote it as 2 minus half, subscript minus half. It doesn't carry any color. All right? Now, the reason why it all of a sudden allows us to write things that we couldn't write before, let's just see how that that comes about. So let's start with the simplest part, which let's take the electrons, because they don't carry, there's no color. And so we said that it's hard to write masses. So let's see why it is so. So suppose I wanted to write a mass term for the electron. Remember that there is a spinorial index, alpha. So let's write it. And I want to write a mass term for this guy. So what is the most natural thing to try to do? I'll just try to do alpha, L alpha, L alpha. Now this would be a mass term, just like we had before for the fermion. But this violates a symmetry. Which symmetry does it violate? It violates the hypercharge, right, the U1, because L carries a minus a half. So if I now do this symmetry transformation, minus a half theta of hypercharge times L alpha, you see that this structure goes to e to the theta y. Sorry, there is an I, of course. L alpha, L alpha. So this structure is not allowed. The symmetries of my Lagrangian does not allow me to write this sort of coupling. So that's no good. What about trying to, if I have two of those and I can write down ER, then I can maybe absorb this factor. But then Lorentz invariance is upon you. You cannot take three fermions and contract them into something which is a Lorentz invariant quantity. And pretty much anything else you would try, right-handed neutrinos, whatever you like, you would not be able to write a mass term for this guy using only fermions. And that's where you need the Higgs field. And so let's see how this is achieved. If I write the Higgs, then this one transforms with a minus a half. Right, there will be a e to the minus half I theta y. And this field transforms with a minus a half. So together they transform as minus 1. But it's also a fermion, so I need something to contract the alpha. Which particle from this list can I pick up so as to contract and get rid of the, contract all the indices and be invariant? If you think carefully, it's actually the right-handed electron, right? Because it transforms the way we wrote things, it will be ER conjugate, So with this choice, it will be a plus a half I theta y. Let me get rid of this index for now. Okay, and so it will be invariant under hypercharge. It will be invariant under SU2 because the Higgs, this SU2 factor cancels against the SU2 of the Higgs, and that part is invariant. The only thing that might confuse you a little bit is this alpha that I just erased, that it's not clear how you contract this left-handed field with this right-handed field. And that's why this notation of right-handed is not very convenient. It's actually more convenient in this business to keep everything left-handed. But let's not deal with that. That's the details that is not that important for the rest of the story. Okay, I'll keep it as left and right just so it's a little more clear. Yeah.
So it's a small point. The L doublet and the H doublet—they're both in the two, right? So.
Right, and the reason why this is still invariant, you might expect that this will be a two, for example, and this is a two bar. That's. It's a possibility. You can make a two bar, and indeed we'll do it in a moment. But even two and two can be contracted because SU2 is a special group, and there are actually real representations. And so even two and two contract into an invariant. Right, this is the special thing about SU2 is that there are actually two invariant tensors. There is alpha, what we call delta ij, but there is also epsilon ij. And so you can make bilinears in two different ways. Okay, so this is the way to create mass terms, and we can do the same thing. So we usually put a little coupling y electron in the same ways that we had the Yokawa coupling for our simple theory, right? And we can similarly write. So let me put the. Yeah. Okay. You can similarly write the coupling for the quarks. So there is an up one, Q, H, U, C. Sorry, U, right? And it turns out that this actually has to be a conjugate field. So H conjugate is just taking the Pauli, the second Pauli matrix, times I times H star, okay, or H dagger. It's not a detail that will be important for this course, so if you don't care about it, forget it. And finally, there is the part that gives mass to the down quarks. Okay? Now, there is one thing that is not manifest here, and that is the flavor structure. The fact that, in fact, I have ups and downs, I have charms and strange, and I have tops and bottoms, I have three generations. How do we manifest that fact? We put little indices. So I and J. And that means that now my coupling is a matrix. And similarly for the quark fields and the down couplings. So now we have those three matrices that are responsible for the mass of the different quarks and leptons. And those matrices have very intricate structure to them. Naively, you might have expected, oh, those are just diagonal matrices. They just give you a mass. But it turns out that they are not diagonal. Those matrices are, all their components are populated. And not only that, they're not real matrices. They have some imaginary pieces to them. And the Lagrangian is, of course, at the end of the day, real, but those matrices have complex phases. And those complex phases were the other big surprise of the last 50 years in particle physics, and they are what's giving rise to CP violation, to the violation of charge and parity symmetries. And it's all coming from those seemingly harmless or uninteresting matrices. It's all coming from the fact that there are, in fact, 3x3 matrices here, not 2x2 and not 1x1. So all this beautiful structure that has to do with CP violation, CP violation, mind you, correspond to time violation, right? It affects that certain processes go this way but not this way in time. And it's all coming from those matrices. And over the past, let's say, 50 years or so, we have learned a great, great deal about this entire structure, from precisely how those fields talk to each other, precisely how the color fields talk to each other. We now have lattice gauge theories that describe how this field condenses and give you protons and neutrons. We have amazing experiments that measure the masses of all these particles and the different components and how they mix and how they talk to each other, including the complex phases. And so this picture has been experimentally verified to an amazing accuracy. And not just the classical Lagrangian. So everything that I've written to you here is a classical level. It's just the Lagrangian, the bare Lagrangian. But this picture has been verified at the quantum level, even up to 3 loops or 4 loops. Okay. So in some sense, it's truly a marvel of human ingenuity that we have managed to come up with this extremely accurate picture of nature. All right. But so this is all nice and dandy, but that's not what you're here for. You're here because you want to learn about beyond the star model physics, right? So let's see where does it start popping its head. And the most recent addition to the star model is what we see as the new scalar boson at the LHC. And how did we discover it? What is the process by which we believe we see it, or believe we see it? The production is through what's called gluon fusion. So you have two gluons. Those are the particles that appear under the SU3 color. Those are the carriers of color charge. And they merge into tops. There is a top loop because they talk to the top particle, right? The top particle carries color. And so they talk to this particle, and they can create a quantum loop of those particles. And the top itself talks to the Higgs particle through this operator. Now think how beautiful this is. It's a marriage of every component of the star model, the gluon fields, the matter fields, and finally you connect to the Higgs field through this coupling. And all of this is done through quantum mechanics. Right, this is a quantum mechanical process. It doesn't happen at the classical level. So this is how we produced it. Now, why am I not writing things like a loop of ups or a loop of bottoms or a loop of downs? Why am I concentrating on a loop of tops? There is no deep physical reason or deep fundamental reason why this is so. It just happens to be that the top particle is the heaviest particle we know of. And that, in turn, as you probably learned in Mark's course, means that the Yokawa coupling, this coupling that is associated with the top quark, the part that describes how the top couples to the Higgs, is the largest in the star model. It's actually one, pretty much exactly one. All right? And all the other particles, like the bottom, the up, the down, have couplings which are much, much smaller than that. So they do contribute. They also participate in this quantum dance, but they are completely irrelevant as far as actual production is concerned. The contribution is minuscule. All right, so this is how we produce the Higgs at the LHC. Have you ever actually calculated this process in Mark's course? Okay. We're probably not going to do it in this course, but if you want to know more about it, just ask me. It's one of the beautiful processes in the star model. But the way it was discovered, so this is how you produce it. That's not very useful because you also need to actually discover it. How do we actually discover it? Does someone know what was the evidence or what is currently the evidence for the Higgs, strongest evidence? Anyone? It's in the news, blogs. How did we discover the Higgs? What is the main channel that we observed the Higgs? It was not two ducks emerging out of the detector. What did people observe? I should say beavers because we're in Canada. What do people actually observe in the detector? Huh? Photons. What we are seeing the Higgs decaying into, or the channel where we see this resonance appearing, is two photons emerging into the detector. Now, if you think about it, it's extremely beautiful, right? This is exactly what people use today for PET scans, for positron electron tomography, right? You have they inject some radioactive material into you. The positron travels in your body, emits an electron, annihilates into two photons, and this is what they, you know, they put you into this big thing, and this is what they're looking for. They're looking for two photons emerging out of your body. And exactly the same sort of idea is happening here, where the Higgs decays into two photons. Those are much more energetic photons, and the detector is much larger. But ultimately, there is this beautiful unity between those processes. This is also just looking for two photons emerging out of the collision point. But how does the Higgs do that? It turns out that there is no coupling here that I've written down where the Higgs couples to two photons. So how does the Higgs decay to two photons? Again, it's through quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanically, the Higgs does couple to W bosons. And W bosons are charged. Those are the carriers among the carriers of the weak force. And so they form a loop. And from this loop, you get those two photons emerging. So in some ways, it's the reverse of this process where two gluons come in and fuse and give you a Higgs. Here, the Higgs take out of the vacuum electroweak gauge bosons, which give you off photons. So in that sense, it's very different than positron electron tomography, where you literally have a direct annihilation of positrons and electrons. Here, it's a beautiful quantum mechanical process where you take out of the vacuum the last remaining piece of the star model, the electroweak gauge boson, and use them to convert into pure energy. Right? So there is something truly, truly beautiful about the way it was discovered and how it appears in the star model. So again, we want to actually calculate. Have you calculated this in this course, in Mark's course? No, OK. We want to actually calculate these processes. But these processes should, if you look at them carefully, so start being disturbing to you. Because we have seen in this original Lagrangian, remember that there is a reason why I kept it on the board. Remember, the problem with this original Lagrangian that we wrote down was that the scalar in this Lagrangian kept wanting to be heavy. It had quantum corrections that kept wanting it to be as massive as the highest energy scale. Where do we see couplings like scalar to something else here? Well, here they are. Here is the Higgs coupling to top. Here is the Higgs coupling to W's. So we now have empirical evidence that this scalar behaves quantum mechanically. Right, we have seen its production and its decay. So we should wonder what else would quantum mechanics do to this? What else can quantum mechanics modify in the properties of this Higgs? And this is when things becoming interesting, because we can ask what kind of things it can do. Well, I can have a top loop correcting the Higgs mass in the same way that the little scalar phis that we have in the original Lagrangian got corrected. And similarly, from here, I can have W loops. It turns out that there are actually two kind of loops. There is this kind of loop, and there is this kind of loop, where W's correct the Higgs mass. It's the same kind of corrections. And finally, there is the same kind of terms that where the Higgs corrects itself. Higgs. And this is the Yokawa coupling. And we now have numerical values associated with each one of those couplings, right? So this one, we said, we know that this coupling y is in fact numerically just equal to 1. Right, there's a Top-Yokawa coupling. We know that this coupling, which is the electroweak coupling, is roughly 0.65. The strength of that coupling is roughly 0.65. And finally, the quartic, this is the last piece of the star model that we just learned about. The quartic coupling in a star model is related to the mass of the Higgs, the mass of the physical Higgs, divided by the electroweak scale. So you might not know what is the Higgs discovered is, but what is the mass of the Higgs that was discovered? You know that? What? 125 or 26, depending on the precise resolution. And so we have a number for this lambda, because V is just the electroweak scale. And so if you plug in 2 times 126 squared divided by 246 squared, you'll get a number which is roughly 0.5. So we can now calculate numerically what those different diagrams will give you. And you cannot really say things like, well, maybe quantum mechanics doesn't participate for scalar, or something strange happens or something like that. We have empirical evidence that this is happening in other kind of processes. And we know what is the problem. We have worked out exactly this problem in the simplified model. We know that no matter what you'll put in the loop, this diagram would want to go like the heaviest scale in your theory, which, you know, as far as we know, is the Planck scale. So how come the Higgs field, with all these different corrections, how come it's so light? Well, this simple theory is also giving us one possible answer, that maybe there are some other particles that we haven't observed yet that exactly cancel each one of those divergences. Remember that we saw that in this simple theory, there was one such divergence coming from the fermions, but there was another divergence coming from the Higgs talking to itself, and it came with an opposite sign. Right? And if we just set the coupling right, that's what you'll do in your assignment, the Y, the Yokawa coupling, and the lambda, the quartic, we saw that in that theory, there was this special cancellation between the two divergences. So similarly here, we would want to have some sort of partner to the top that can maybe go in loops. Higgs, Higgs, and something called the stop that will exactly cancel the contribution from this harmful diagram. And for this diagram, we would want to have some new partner, something called the Wino, that will go in loops and maybe do something like that, that will exactly cancel this diagram. I'm just giving it those wiggly lines because it's a special type of fermion. But we want something like that to happen to exactly cancel the contribution from the W boson. And finally, for this diagram, we want some new particle, again a fermion, which is called the Higgsino, to exactly cancel the contribution from the Higgs self-coupling. And in fact, if you want to do it carefully, we need to do it for every particle in the star model to have a full symmetry. Okay? But the idea is as simple as the idea we encountered in this very simplified theory, where we had a spin half and a spin zero particle, and when you put them together, there is a way to make this quadratic divergence go away. Okay? So we won't have time to talk too much about supersymmetry today. We'll do it next time. And next time, we'll already see how we can try to test it. But the idea here is very simple. We can get a sense already from this simple diagram, and that's what we'll do in the next 5 minutes, because it's just arithmetics, and even when you're asleep, you can do arithmetics. Let's just try to estimate. I mean, this might be true, but maybe those particles are extremely heavy. So we can try to estimate how heavy those particles have to be to give this cancellation, right? just to see whether we have hope to see it. Well, so let's go back to this board. So we want to, so the physical Higgs mass we know is about 100 GeV square, 125, but doesn't matter. Now we know it's made up of a bare mass plus quantum corrections, right? The quantum corrections we just learned, let's take, for example, this top loop. How does it look like? It looks like the top Yokawa square divided by 16 pi square times the cutoff of my theory. The cutoff of the theory is roughly where that new partner will show up. Remember, in dim reg, this is precisely what we saw. We saw that the cutoff of this theory will basically be the mass of this new particle, the mass of the stop. So instead of talking about the cutoff, let me just talk about the mass of the stop. So now what do I require? I want to make sure that when I take the bare mass and I add it to this one, maybe there is a minus sign, that doesn't really matter. But I want to make sure that all these three quantities are roughly the same order of magnitude. Otherwise, I need somehow this to be huge, this to be huge, and somehow they have to combine to be something very small. Because I know empirically this is only 100 GeV. So basically what I want from this relation, if you look at it carefully, you essentially want this term, the quantum correction, to be roughly the same order of magnitude as 100 GeV. And from that we can solve, right, if y square over 16 pi square times the mass of the stop has to be roughly 100 GeV square, then we find out that the mass of the stop is basically 4 pi times 100 GeV divided by y top, but y top is 1. So this gives me roughly 1200 GeV. Now, what is a GeV? The proton weighs a GeV, right? The highest accelerator we have today, which is the LHC, will go to energy scales which are 10 times larger than this, 14 TeV or 13 TeV. So this energy scale, even if it doesn't mean anything to you in terms of, you know, you're not used to those units, this is energy scale that is now accessible. We can probe those energies today in colliders, and this is exactly what we are hoping to see. These simple arguments, and they are simple, they may be wrong, because remember the whole idea of a hierarchy problem is just relying on, you know, not wanting to have fine-tuning. But if this, something like that is right, then we expect those partners, those stop partners, or the Wino, or the Xeno, we expect them, because of this argument, to show up at roughly 1,000 GeV. And so given that our accelerator is 10 times more energetic than that, we have hope to see those particles. Yeah?
So recently there was some talk about how supersymmetry is no longer alive.
So we'll talk about it next time. I'll keep you in suspense over the weekend. So over the weekend you'll be troubling yourself, is Suzy alive or not? And we'll talk about it next time. But what I want you to take home from this business is just that thinking about these very simple theories that we start with, fermion plus scalar, and then knowing what is empirically verified, the star model, we can come up and kind of understand the idea of supersymmetry very simply. It all has to do with this quadratic divergence of the scalar. And so if you understand this simple theory, the scalar plus fermion, as silly as it looks like, it's a theory that contains many of the beautiful effects of field theory. In fact, even anomalies, as I mentioned to one of you, even anomalies, gauge anomalies and global anomalies appears in this theory. Okay, so try to understand maybe at least this argument of fine-tuning and why it implies new particles, new states at at TeV. Yeah.
Is the 1.1 a convention or experimental data?
Both. It depends on exactly how you define the Yokawa coupling. So this is when you define it's when you define without a half in front, and when you define the Higgs VEV without with a square root two. So in some sense, it's a convention. But either way you put it, it's an order. It's really an order one number.
So you mean that if you fix the coupling of Higgs and top, then other things is smaller than this.
That's right. So for example, if you ask what is y in this convention, what is y of the bottom quark? It's about a 50th of this. It's 1 over 50, or 0.02, which is much, much smaller.
So we just chose this to be 1.
In some sense, but in some sense, it's actually very natural for this choice is very natural.
So if we discover a more heavier quark, so we set that coupling
to... No. So it's not that. That heavier thing will really have to be y of larger than 1. Yeah, so the convention is just that it's whether this or that it's square root 2. Instead of 1, it will have to be square root 2, which is larger than 1. So it's not as convention as you might. This coupling is order 1, either way you put it. But really the important thing is what it implies on this. And this statement is convention independent. Okay? So have a good weekend, everyone. Sorry, yeah.
So presumably you have to solve the fine-tuning problem of the Higgs mass?
That's right.
Don't we need a fine-tuning to get y equal to lambda?
No, because in this limit, in the limit where y equal to lambda, this is exactly the technical naturalness. In that limit, there is an enhanced symmetry that keeps this relation alive. And so you don't need to tune it at the gut scale, whatever high scale you have to keep a relation, because the symmetry itself of your theory keeps that relation. All right, so have a good weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.